You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Yesterday's open line, we needed 2 hours, so I'm going to suggest that we continue where we left off. You can say, nope, actually I'm bored with the theme that you're about to introduce, your CBS. I want to talk about jokes or sport or entertainment or ethics or economics or whatever else, but I do want to make good on my promise. That last conversation we had towards the end of the open line yesterday was around this question of what the appropriate attitude should be towards questions of anti-black racism on the part of white progressive. And I told you that there were problematic aspects of particularly white allyship that I wanted to explain. Because there was a gentleman who called in Dolph, and as far as I'm concerned, Dolph was just being nakedly bigoted. But after him, there were 2 white callers who called in, and they critiqued Dolph. But their critiques, for me, demonstrate why there's a spectrum of problematic thinking when it comes to allyship. So the first guy basically calls in and is on some, yeah, a lot of things that Dolph said was like problematic, but I think what Dolph really wanted to say was, and you know that tactic of trying to make the racist sound palatable by saying that, man, this guy's just using poor language. He's misunderstood. Here's the sophisticated version of what he's saying. I've got privilege, but black people should emulate white people, Eusebius. They should just do what we were doing. And it's interesting to me because a lot of people who are self-styled allies in the fight against anti-black racism are located in that kind of political thought, where they very quickly say something that is actually hugely, hugely substantive, like, sure, I've got white privilege, but... And that's a rhetorical trick, because they don't really want to spend time on the important hard work describing and self-examining their privileges. They want to get on to the bits after the word but. And that's always an indication to me of where their true politics actually lie. Because it means that that is the bit that they find to be the most salient, the most important, and what they truly, truly think is actually where the heart of the South African discourse should be located. And I don't fall for that kind of trickery. There's a nuance there that I think matters genuinely. How you divvy up your time, any problem that you solve, whether it be a class problem, whether it be a corporate problem, whether it be a problem in a school that you are running, what you decide to prioritize tells me a lot about what you truly think is the most important issue to solve for. And if you think that the biggest problem with black people is that they're simply not building structures, then that suggests to me that you probably have some center-right view that black people are indifferent, uncreative, or maybe even lazy and not pulling themselves up by bootstraps that must be lying all over them, all over their houses. And that's exactly my problem, is that that person thought of himself as fundamentally different to Dolph, but actually he's just more sophisticated in how he views black people. But the sophistication doesn't mask problematic aspects in that progressive thinking, and I put it in heavy scare quotes, because the implicit premises in that caller's analysis of Dolph and where he meets Dolph halfway is this idea that but for black people simply waking up one day working hard, they could be living in a world where inequality is reduced. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. That is deeply ahistorical, and it does not take account of the fact that the material conditions of millions of black people continue to be absolutely horrid in this country. So that's what was problematic with that. Then there was a gentleman at about 5 to 10 that called in that was even, for me, even more problematic, who started off by saying, I've got one message for Dolph, go to Orania. But then when you shut up and listen actively and generously and closely, magic happens. Because people reveal their true selves in the details of what they say when you keep quiet and you just let them speak. The longer someone speaks for, the more out of control with their word choices they become, the more they truly reveal the attitudes and belief structures that fundamentally define their politics. Because the first 30 seconds, 1 minute, 90 seconds on radio when you speak, and I'll give you a trick, free advice for you, you are in control of your narrative. The longer you speak, especially without notes and an auto cue, the more you are likely to actually take us into your heart. And later on, we had the Ubuntu talk. If only we see each other's humanity. If only we started, Eusebius, to take Ubuntu seriously. And then, unfortunately, by then, we had to go to the news with Tara. Because what I wanted to critique at that point, and this is where we're going to start the show right now, is the limitations of Ubuntu speak and humanity speak. And that's, again, where a lot of allyship falls short. You've got to locate this conversation. As I said on Christian Amanpour's show, I said the same to Deborah Petter for a CBS News insert, and I said it on the show yesterday. We cannot divorce the conversation about white privilege and about how to dismantle racism in our society from questions of social and economic power. And all this highfalutin kumbayazm around Ubuntu talk and humanity talk, it bypasses tough conversations about the material conditions under which most black people live. And I think that for me is why a lot of white progressive thought is easy. And I want to say this before I bring on Prof. Crispin Hampson, that you also can't set the bar very low for yourself as a white ally in the fight against racism. It's easy to come on radio and say, Dolph, I've got a message for you, but not in my name. Dolph, I've got a message for you, Swar, go to Orania. That's not an achievement for one white person to call out a Hofmeyer and say, Hofmeyer, go to Orania. That's actually a very low bar for allyship. The higher bar is to tell me what conversations are you having with mom and dad and with your children. What are the characters looking like in the books that you read for your kids? Do you have black heroes in the books that you read for your kids? Who are the godparents of your kids? Who are the friends and family that come round every weekend for a braai? Do they look like the gardener and the domestic worker, or do they look like you? That kind of tapestry of the social landscape within which your life is lived will tell me far more about the depth of your commitment as an ally to an anti-racist South Africa than your ability to tell Steve Hofmeyer to F off. So we also need to make sure that we understand how hard it is to be truly, truly an ally. And it is not as easy as simply calling in and saying, Dolph, let's be clear, but you need to go to Orania. That is an incredibly minimal standard of excellence to allow yourself as an ally for a fight in an anti-racist society. 702. Open line. And then there's a part of the conversation that requires white people to also talk about the ways in which they have, in the language of Crispin Hampson, been recruited into whiteness, which is a really beautiful turn of phrase. And of course, Crispin is the director of the International Center of Nonviolence at DUT. And I asked him this morning, please spare us a couple of minutes to articulate this excellent comment you'd made on Facebook and to do so with a platform like this fantastic one at 702 and speaking to a wider audience. Crispin, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Eusebius. Shall I just launch into this?
Yeah, launch into it. I'll sit back and take your time. I know I said you'd take a minute or two, but actually the point is so important. Articulate it as fully as you want to.
Yeah, so, I was thinking about this, and when white people like myself are accused of racism, often what we do is we marshal our defenses. We become very careful. And we're trying to avoid dealing with some very hurtful things. And so why is it so hurtful for us to be called racist? I mean, people can say all kinds of things. You did this wrong. You did that wrong. We don't feel quite the same shame. And I think this issue of shame is actually at the heart of it. Because for me, if you're white in this society, whether you are now progressive or reactionary, whatever, racism was your own defeat. As a child, you were defeated in your attempt to feel fully human in society. And why it's hard, what makes it a bit hard for a lot of white people, I think, in seeing this, is that the way that was done to you was often not very violent. It was coaxing. No, you're being steered away from that person. You're being told to associate with those people. Because we white South Africans tend to grow up with black people very close by. So there's this constant pressure to align yourself with us and not with them. Mm. And by the time we're adults, we've actually forgotten that process, I think. We don't notice it. To see it is, I think, it requires that you have a degree of empathy for yourself and for others to feel that was a horrible process. We white people should be enraged by racism because it's our defeat. It's our shame. And we're not dealing with that shame by trying to prove how progressive we are, how anti-racist we are. So I have a twin brother, and he said to me something about child abuse. And he said, what we experienced growing up was child abuse, but it was racial abuse at the hands of white people. We were being recruited into supporting the structures. And it's essential for those structures to continue for young white people to serve allegiance to them, because these structures don't exist without human agency as well. So I'm thinking about situations that I've been in where, I mean, a couple of times I've been accused of being racist. And like, okay, so let's not defend here. How did I get into this position? What's happening here that's landed me into this position that I feel very, very uncomfortable about? So, and I don't think it's for black people to do very much here. There's no work white people need to do, you know, for themselves in a way, to recapture that sense of solidarity with other people. Because we know, I mean, from what Beagle wrote about, that similar processes were being done to black people, have been and continue being done to black people, to remind them of the other side, you know, to secure their allegiance to the position they find themselves in. I was influenced in my thinking by Beagle and people like Rick Turner, who engaged with him a lot.
So let me ask you this, Crispin, because you said a mouthful and all of it beautiful and word perfect, which is why I wasn't interrupting. And I wish every single phenotypically white person across the globe could hear you. I'm going to put it in a podcast, my remarks, plus your commentary and the exchange we're about to have. And we'll just put that out into the blogosphere and see what happens, or into the internet. You use the word shame. It's an interesting moral emotion. It's a moral emotion that can get people hot and bothered. We spend a lot of time, both in philosophy of psychology and also in psychology, thinking through shame, when it is an appropriate emotion to feel. And I want to go in there because I think you've touched on a nerve, but a critically important emotion and affect that we need to connect to questions of whiteness. I don't think anyone wakes up and wants to think of themselves, and it's a point I've reiterated very often. None of us think of ourselves as fundamentally indecent. And when your skin color, even through no choice of your own intergenerationally, has been implicated in the making of a racist society, there is shame to be felt about what had been done intergenerationally as a result of the moral sins of your grandparents, for example. What do you say to white people who struggle with that? Because at an individual level, Dirk may be listening to you right now and go, Crispin, you left-wing idiot. You are conceding too much to that Eusebius character. I, as Dirk, as an individual, am a fundamentally decent person. Some of my best friends are black. I treat my staff well. And quite frankly, there are black politicians who treat their staff worse than I do. So the individual narrative goes counter to the group narrative, and therefore it's very hard for an individual white person to understand this idea of historic shame. What do you say to that?
Okay, so I'm not conceding anything to you, Eusebius. What my point is that I'm doing this for myself, not for you. I have to do this because we cannot accept the situation we find ourselves in. It is so repugnant to us. And I think this thing of decency is critical, because when I grew up in the 1950s, 60s, Natal. So, like, at some point, my older brother's best friend, they got into trouble together, and we were close to the family. His father was our maths teacher and a really good person. Later on, my brother realized that, hold on, his best friend's grandfather was the person who instituted the Durban system, was responsible for this monstrosity of a system that was developed in Durban and spread throughout South Africa. Now, it's so hard, I think, for white people growing up. Our sense of decency is so caught up with family with community, with church, with language. We grew up with a feeling that, okay, we English, we're not responsible for what these Afrikaans nationalists have done. I mean, but I think when I really began interacting with Afrikaans people a bit later, I began realizing, hold on, we can't fool ourselves forever. This is our doing.
Mm.
And the people we saw as decent, good people, the people that we whose values we sought to emulate, were also implicated in so many different ways in the system. And that's hurtful to acknowledge.
You know, Crispin, it's such a beautiful point. So many people want to come in here. I'll give you a final minute, but I want to just underscore one of the many points you've made that is so beautiful to me. And in a lighthearted manner, and on another occasion, you and I should talk about the beauty of humor to navigate complexity. But in a lighthearted manner, you make a point that, of course, that is not before some woke person misdirects the conversation, that is not intended to be a genuine, literal expression of deep selfishness. That when you say you're not conceding anything, this is fundamentally about you. It is an important point, that, right? Because the way I hear you generously is that what you're saying to me is, Eusebius, even as a white person, I am wounded and I have something that needs to be restored in terms of my own humanity in recalibrating my social relations with black people. And I can't see why someone would want to opt out of a journey that isn't just about justice for black people, but fundamentally restoring the group dignity and therefore the dignity at an individual level of every single white person, which means that all of us in our interpersonal relations have something to be gained in this kind of work.
Mm. I think, look, in the end, this has a material basis. It's about the desire to have money, to have wealth, to have people working for you. That idea is fatally flawed, because our sense of integrity clashes with that in reality. You can't pursue money and you can't pursue advantage without sacrificing something. And I think that's hard for white people because our sense of having a decent life is so caught up in these things, that the sense of desperation, of trying to win back through something else, material advantage, educational advantage, a huge thing. We try and win back through those things some way of remedying what we lost as young people, and for me it's very hurtful even to talk about that, even now, that it is a wound, and it's our wound. It's not something that black people have any responsibility for. We have to do something about this, and if it means giving up on some of the other stuff, well, what choice can you make with integrity?
Beautifully put. Beautifully put. Every single word landed beautifully. Thank you, Crispin. Thank you so much for the work you've been doing.
Thanks.
That's Prof. Crispin Hampson, who's Director of International Center of Nonviolence at Durban University of Technology.